Good evening. We're starting Parshat Mishpatim. Our parsha is loaded with mitzvot. We'll just go plow through slowly. The parsha begins with Ela Mishpatim. These are the laws, the justice system. Asher tasim lifneihem, that you should place before them. And Chazal understood this pasuk to be telling us many things. Number one, we're supposed to go to the Jewish court. The Jewish court rules by Jewish law. That's the way a Jew is supposed to live. You have an issue with your landlord. You have an issue with your employer. You have an issue with your partner. So there's a Jewish legal system that the Torah gives us. Someone did you damage. You harmed someone else. So we have a Jewish court. There's a Beis Din. And we're not supposed to go to any other court. Part of leading a Jewish life is that we adhere to the laws of the Torah and monetary matters as well. Now, the halacha factors in social norms and contracts, obviously, and agreements. But the halacha has us. The Torah gave us a system of how to rule on monetary matters. A person has to understand the system in order to know how to play the system. Meaning, you want to set up a contract with your partner, Jewish or non-Jewish, and at the end of the day, you're going to have to go to court in a Jewish court, then you better get some counsel as you set up the contract by someone who knows the Jewish system. Because it's not the same as the non-Jewish system. And there are many, many differences, and you need someone who could counsel you on how to set up the contract. And again, there are courts that will help you do that. It can be done, and it should be done. So that's the first thing. Asher tasim lifneihem, we're supposed to go to a Jewish court when we have an issue. So your travel agent ripped you off. They told you have a round-trip ticket. You flew there. You need to take the trip back, and suddenly you have no ticket. And your travel agent says it wasn't her fault. She didn't do it, whatever. But she took your full prize, full fare. So you're supposed to sue her in a Jewish court? Try. What will probably happen is that your travel agent won't want to go to the court. And then there are many scenarios where the court will give a person a document that says he tried taking this to a Jewish court, being as we cannot bring the other person to us to be judged, we're giving him authorization to take matters to the regular courts. So there is such a thing. Sometimes you cannot pursue it in the Jewish court. You won't get anywhere. So then the Jewish court will sometimes give you a document that says you're permitted to go to the regular courts. Here in Israel, the courts do not work based on the Jewish law. They work based on British law, based on all kinds of laws that were passed here in Israel. But it's not based on what the Torah says. So going to a court here, even though the justice and the lawyer and both sides are all Jewish, that doesn't mean you went to a Jewish court, right? They're not ruling based on the Torah. So same thing applies. You're supposed to go to a Beis Din. In order for a court to really function, so the members of the court have to have tradition all the way back to Moshe. They have to have smicha, that they're ordained by someone who was ordained, by someone who was ordained, all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And we lost that at some point in Jewish history. So our courts are limited. They cannot rule on every matter. The courts have license to rule on matters that are common, things that happen often, so there the courts will give a ruling. The things that are rare, so there the courts say, I don't have license to rule on that. So even though there are many laws in the Torah, we don't rule on every one of those laws. Our courts are limited. Okay, so we have the legal system. Our parsha, with its details, is giving us the details of the Ten Commandments. If we have in Lo Tigzol, don't steal, so now we're going to see our rights. What do I own? What don't I own? And the first mitzvah, when it comes to the legal system, is the mitzvah of Eved Ivri. A Jew who has to sell himself into being a servant. So here the Torah is teaching us one aspect of the social net that exists. We know societies today very often have a social net, and it's a big challenge. How do you set that up? On the one end, you want to care for the underprivileged in society. On the other end, you don't want people taking advantage of it. How do you do that? I mean, some people have it so good on welfare, they have no interest in getting a job. Someone once came collecting to our house, and I said, why don't I help you get a job? And he said, you know how much I make an hour? You can't get me a job that makes that much money an hour. I said, really? How much do you make an hour? He said, I could reach 100 shekel an hour. So some doors I knock at, they give me 2 shekel, 5 shekel, 10 shekel. You factor in an hour, I could knock on, let's say, 40, 50 doors. So I can each door I knock on takes a minute or two. I can easily hit 70, 80 shekel an hour. 70, 80 shekel an hour. Why should the guy leave tzedakah collecting? He's making more money collecting tzedakah than he can make working a job. So that's not a good system. The Torah gives us a social system. If a person can't afford life, he's run into debts and he can't pay them off, so there comes a point that a person could sell himself as a servant. And then that has a lot of details. Number one, the master takes over all of his time. Number two, the master takes over all of his expenses, in the sense that he doesn't have to pay his wife, he doesn't have to make sure she has food to eat and clothing to eat, and his children. Part of being a servant is that the master must give him, take care of the wife and children. He gives them food, he gives them clothing, he takes care of them as well. So that's the social system, that he has a social net. Worst case scenario, he could sell himself as a servant, but then he loses his freedom. You know, the master could tell him, today I want you to spend your day washing dishes. Tomorrow I want you to spend the day watering the lawn. He cannot put him down. He can't make him do pointless labor or cruel labor or labor that'll make him really be broken. But he can ask him to do all kinds of menial tasks. You know, shine my shoes for the rest of the day. All my 300 pairs of shoes, I want you to shine them. He's not going to do whatever he enjoys. He might spend the day harvesting the crops. Might be out in the sun all day. Okay, he sold himself as a servant. He's going to have to work. Now, the flip side is he'll get a good meal. If everyone else is eating lamb chops, he gets lamb chops. They can't tell him, you take rye bread, leave us with the lamb chops. The master's drinking good wines, he can't tell him, you drink water. No, he has to treat him in that sense decently. If there's only one pillow, he gets the pillow. He has to treat him decently in that sense. The Torah wants him to retain a certain amount of dignity. He is a fellow Jew. So that's why Chazal said these laws of the Torah, Kana Eved, Kana Adon Natsmo. You think you bought a servant, you bought yourself a master. Because you have to treat him so well in so many ways that it's almost like a master. The halacha says, you treat him like a brother, he treats you like a master. Meaning you, the owner, have to treat him like a brother, he's a fellow Jew. He has to understand he's your servant and treat you like a master. So each side is supposed to be forthcoming to the other side in the relationship between the servant and the master. Okay, yes.
Rashi says that he also has to his family, right? He also has to give his family. So does he also have to give the rest of the family lamb chops?
No. From this halacha, yes.
Is there a punishment given if he doesn't listen? If the servant doesn't listen?
There are different penalties that he could impose technically, yeah. So, you guys ready to think? Yes? Or it's too late at night? Can we go deeply for 1 second? Okay, we have a concept in laws of derivation that when we derive things, we always derive to the minimum. Meaning, let's say I would say, you can take cookies from that bag. So you can interpret that to mean I can take a limitless amount of cookies. You can interpret that to mean cookies means two. I can take cookies. I can take two. I don't know if I can take more than that. So if I took two, I'm covered. I did right. If I took three, well, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I don't know what the person meant. So that's a rule in derivation. When we analyze words that are spoken, we say tafasta merube. If you try to grab on to a lot, lo tafasta, you don't have a hold on it, because you don't know whether that was included in the intent. So whenever we analyze psukim, we take them to the minimum. We say, how much have I proven that the pasuk means to say? That's a rule in derivation. We never derive more than I can prove. If I have to guess, well, it probably means more. Well, you don't know. So if you don't know, then you don't have that. So far, makes sense? Yes. Okay. So now let's look at the parasha. The Torah says that the owner has to fund the servant and his wife and his child. Well, how old does he have to fund the child? When the child is a year old, 2 years old, 10 years old, 20 years old? To what age does the master have to fund him? So we assume that the wife gave birth the day he bought the servant. So you have to fund a child when he is 1 day old. How long do you have to fund him for? Well, the longest time that a servant can be a servant is 6 years. Right? After 6 years, he goes free. You cannot buy a Jew for more than 6 years. So that's, from here we learn the halacha. You see that the master has to fund the children up to 6 years old. Up to the time the child is a full 6 years old. And from here we learn the halacha that a parent must fund his child up to 6 years old. This is the source of that halacha, because here you see that the master takes over the child's needs. How long does he have to take him over for? Till 6 years old. So, one of my children once asked me, I'm past 6 years old, Abba, are you still going to get me clothing? So I said, yeah. So, well, we learn at home, right? That one of the older kids said, yeah, but Abba doesn't have to. So I said, right, if a person chooses not to, so the kid said, so what do you do? They said, okay, Abba, you're the rabbi. What happens if someone in the community says to a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, I'm not getting you clothing, go fight for yourself. What do? I said, we arrange a protest. The whole community comes out in front of his house with banners, and we say, even the average animal takes care of its kin. You're like a raven. You don't care about your own kids. What's wrong with you? You're not normal. We protest in front of his house. So the kid said, that's a nice idea. What did they do in the days of the Gemara? I said, that's what they did in the days of the Gemara. The Gemara says this is what they did. That if a person after the child was 6 years old said, fend for yourself. What do you want from me, buddy? Go deal. So the Gemara says they used to go in front of his house and make protests. This idea of protesting, they'd embarrass him. They'd say, even animals take care of their next of kin. And this guy, look at him, he's worse than an animal. He won't take care of his children just because they're past 6 years old. So here we see, technically, biblically, I have to take care of my kid until 6 years old. And beyond that, so if a person can't afford it, you can't force them. If a person has whatever cause not to do it, so they don't have to do it. But under normal circumstances, no one tells their kids when they're 6 years old, buddy, go deal. That's not normal. And if we were aware of it, we would argue with the person. We would try to convince them they should take care of their kids until their kids can really take care of themselves. Yes? Who said we don't begin by protesting? Who said our first step is to pick up the bats? Even in this case, our first step isn't to protest. Our first step is to talk to the person.
But you can't leave to be
involved. In this case or in a get?
In this case.
No. We don't have a halachic right in this case to beat him up. No. He's within his rights. I can't beat him up. I can tell him it's indecent. I can impose different things upon him to make it uncomfortable so that he will take care of his children. But I can't beat him up over this, no. It technically is within his rights. The Torah says if the servant was married, so then the owner can tell him, I want you to spend your nights giving me more children. meaning your own wife and your kids are your kids. But if he has servants that are not Jewish, so he could tell his Jewish servant, you spend your nights in the with the different women. Chazal didn't view this as a punishment. And Chazal viewed this as something that the servant might actually like, that he could have all these different women. Ordinarily, a Jew doesn't have that option. He can't have, under normal circumstances, a Jew has one wife, and certainly he doesn't have women who are not Jewish. Over here, this Jewish servant is suddenly being allowed to have children on behalf of the master. The Torah only allows him to do this if he has a wife. Someone that's going to grab him back and say, don't stick with her. But the Torah warns us it might happen that he'll get pretty attached to the lady or ladies he's with who are servants, non-Jewish servants in the home he's working in. So Chazal didn't want that. The Torah didn't want that. The Torah only allowed him to go with these women if he has a wife. And even so, it might happen. This idea teaches us a halachic concept. There are different levels of ownership. I own the pen, I have a physical ownership over the pen. If I own a grain in which I can tithe the grain and I can make trumos and maestros, I not only have monetary ownership, I also have halachic ownership, right? I have spiritual ownership over that grain. So Chazal say the fact that this Jew, when he's in the possession of another Jew, is suddenly allowed to marry a woman who's not really Jewish, shows us that the possession of a Jewish servant is not only a physical monetary ownership. What's called kinyan isurim. He has an ownership over the person's religion as well on some level. The Torah gives him an ownership over his observance. The Torah says you could tell him to marry someone. You could tell him to sleep with someone tonight. We view an act of intimacy as not only a physical act, but a halachic act. So that's unusual. Now, before we move on, we have to understand, so a Jewish servant is allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman? The answer is no. The way it works, when a non-Jew enters as a servant in a Jewish home. So let's understand what happened. We went to war. We won the war. We won the war, so sometimes we take over the country and they pay us taxes. Sometimes they fight us and they're not willing to pay taxes, they're not willing to be subservient, we fight them to the end. We fight them to the end, then we take over the country. When we take over the country, we can choose to leave them as citizens, we can also choose to take them as prisoners. Meaning, now that they fought us and we fought to the end, now that we own the country, we own the people. Technically, at that point, we can take the people that were conquered as servants. Now, a servant that enters a Jew's possession, let's say, not at war. You went to the slave market, they were selling slaves. There's a slave market today, you know that. So you go to the slave... What?
No, in Africa
there's a slave market. The Muslims sell Christians all the time into slavery. There's a huge slave market. Not only in Africa, in Holland too?
No, because all the
ISIS.
Okay, right. I'm saying not only in Africa, right? ISIS sells people into slavery. Not only females into specific type of slavery. There's real slavery out there today. What? It's been happening long before ISIS. There was a slave trade in Africa long before ISIS. ISIS didn't start it. The Western world chose to ignore it. But Muslims were selling Christians into slavery all the time. Meaning in the last... when I was a kid, I did a book report on, I did like a report on slavery. So it was around back then too, saying it's been around for decades. And the world's aware of it. Meaning there are groups of call them terrorists, call them bandits, call them pirates, that travel the deserts, the desert regions of Africa, and when they can, they pounce on people, on Christians, namely, and they sell them in the name of Islam. They sell them into slavery. Men, women, children, I mean, this is an ongoing trade. And Europe is a silent accomplice, because there are people who buy slaves. And keep them under wraps. And it's not only in Africa and South America, there's also a slave trade. Coming back to here. So let's say you want to go buy a servant. Okay, you're going to buy a slave. when he enters a Jew's possession, so he has many benefits. If you hit him and you knocked out his tooth, he goes free. Meaning the Torah warns you, be careful how you treat him. And he's given 1 year to choose if he wants to convert to Judaism. When a Jew purchases a non-Jew, man or woman, he has 1 year to decide if he wants to convert to Judaism. During that year, he remains non-Jewish. By the end of the year, he has to decide, do I want to remain in this person's possession or not? If I remain by him, so then that person has to convert, has to undergo a conversion process. And at the end of that conversion process, he will be an Eved Kenani. He will have middle status. He won't be Jewish, and he won't be non-Jewish. He will be in the middle, what's called an Eved Kenani. He will be a non-Jewish servant in a Jewish home, which means that on some things, he's obligated to do mitzvot like a female, like a Jewish female, which means he has to keep Shabbat, he has to keep kosher. If he says yes, if he says no, then we say, fine, we'll sell you out to a non-Jew. Good luck. And then you could sell him to any non-Jew. It's almost always in his interest to remain. If the Jew is half decent, so he will have a very good life in the Jewish home. Meaning it's not a bad life. You're not free, but it's not a bad life. So when we speak about the Jewish servant marrying a non-Jewish servant in the Jew's home, we're talking about a Shifcha Kananis who already underwent the conversion process, and she's a quasi-Jew. Meaning on the one hand, she's accepted Torah mitzvot, she's gone to mikvah, she did the whole conversion process, but for the sake of being a non-Jewish servant. So she stays in the middle. Coming back to our parsha. So the Torah describes that when the Jewish servant is supposed to go free, he might just say, I don't want to. Now, if being a servant was so bad, then why does the Torah bother addressing this? We see from here that it's not so bad. Not only isn't it so bad, there are people who have a weakness that they have a very hard time dealing with life alone. We see that in the welfare system. These are questions I get all the time, that a person suddenly gets a tenant, the tenant doesn't pay rent, doesn't pay electric, doesn't pay their water bills, doesn't do anything they have to do, they're not competent people, to the point where they're really a burden on society. Now what do you do? So if a person calls up and says, am I supposed to kick him out? The guy might freeze to death, he might starve to death. On the other hand, you own an apartment, you're supposed to make money off that apartment, you have to pay the bills now, you're stuck with all the problems the person brought you into the apartment. So the welfare system doesn't really have a way of dealing with this. Meaning the different homes and the different systems in the welfare system today, we don't have a way of dealing with it. The servant system is really there for those people. For the people who cannot make it alone. The Torah is against having servants. The Torah is not for it. The Torah sets up the system for people who on their own would end up being not only a burden to society, but a harm to society. What ends up happening, when a person has nothing to lose, they're the most dangerous. Right? A person that has nothing to lose, so every crime is worth it, because what can you do to me? What are you going to do? So that's when a person can become dangerous. He's desperate. He sees other people have cars. Other people eat at fancy restaurants. Why wouldn't he find his way to get arms? At some point, a person wants to do what everyone else does. A person doesn't tell himself, well, they worked hard to get there. They had self-control. They didn't waste their money. Self-control is the key to getting ahead in life, right? A person doesn't tell himself that. He says, why does everyone else have it good but me? And so then a person can be very dangerous. So the Torah gave a person an out. You see, you can't deal. You see, things are falling apart in your life. You see, don't go hungry. Don't become a danger to society. Don't become a burden to society. Be productive and let someone else run your life for you. But the Torah is against it. The Torah doesn't like it. The Torah gives him an out. The Torah says that's not the type of life you should be striving to lead. I'll get to you in 1 second. Part of the system the Torah set up is that when the servant goes free, the master is supposed to give him a lot of gifts. He's supposed to come back to life debt-free. When he sold himself, the money went to pay off his debts. Hopefully he's coming back and he can make good on what he's learned being run by someone else. I once visited a pizza store, and the owner said to me, "You should know my pizza store is a big success thanks to your father." I said, "Really? What does my father have to do with your pizza store?" So he said, "My first job was by your father. And by your father, at the end of the day, we'd be very tired. We'd want to leave. And your father would say, 'If you leave, don't come back tomorrow morning.' And all the workers would say, 'Why?' And he'd say, 'You don't leave until you clean up after yourself. We clean, we leave the place clean so we can start working tomorrow morning. And if you didn't clean up, you can't leave. You want to leave? Leave, but don't come back tomorrow morning.'" He said that work ethic, that when you're tired at the end of the day, you don't leave a place dirty. You clean up, and then the next morning you could come and be productive all over again. He said, "That's the success of my pizza store. That work ethic I learned by him. I learned that you can't leave at the end of the day just because you're tired. You have a responsibility to set up shop so that tomorrow morning you can be productive all over again." He said, "If not for that," he said, "my competition, they hit the end of the day, they're tired. They leave the place sloppy. They have bugs. They have vermin. They have disgusting shops. You can't keep up with the dirt you left last night. If you clean up the night before, your whole shop plays the way it should." So that... Yeah. So the night has to prepare for the next morning. It was a lesson to me. Coming back to our parsha. So hopefully the servant has learned lessons on how to lead a productive life, so that when he comes back to the regular citizen's life, he will be productive. Yes.
How can the conversion be considered a sincere conversion unless like a price?
You're right. Ordinarily, non-Jewish servants were not the best Jews. You're right. Their conversion was tainted. You see that when if he ever ends up going free, he has to undergo a new conversion process. You're right. The non-Jewish servant was always suspect of doing, of stealing, of being unfaithful to his wife. It says they were a problematic breed in Am Yisrael. It says if you brought them home, you were bringing trouble to the house. It wasn't recommended.
Sister said that a slave is supposed to be with another person if he's married. How is that good for some time?
It's not.
Starting to break his mind. It goes against what we do. When Abraham get a concubine and Yaakov get a concubine, they criticize the parent concubine, but they're not slaves. And, it's like
the wife recommended that.
He's criticized for listening to the wife. That's what the wife is. She said, "No, it's only you."
Let me ask you a question. If a person steals and goes to jail, is that good for his marriage?
It's maybe not good for his marriage, but I think his wife will be able to forgive him.
So sometimes the social system that's set up cannot factor the collateral damage that something will have in a marriage. Sometimes there are other mitigating factors that override the question of, is it good for the marriage? Meaning you're focused on one angle, and you're right. It cannot be healthy for their marriage to have such a scenario. And yet, the Torah is not interested in his being a Jewish servant. The Torah says this isn't the type of life you're supposed to lead. And if you do, there's going to be a certain price to pay. This isn't about... again, let's take a step back. It wasn't so common that Jews would want to buy servants. Your next door neighbor failed at everything they did. They didn't pay their water bill, they didn't pay their electric bill, they didn't mow their lawn, they leave garbage lying around, he's a slob, and you don't like sitting next to him in shul because he doesn't remember to shower every week. So once a month, maybe he does, but it's not so pleasant. Now he's down on his luck, and he's saying, can you buy me? Can you buy me out? I'll be your servant. Who's the person that ends up being a servant? It's not the person who was a success in high tech, and then you say, great, I bought a servant, he's going to make me a million. It's the guy who was not successful at everything he did, and now he needs someone to bail him out. It wasn't so simple to buy such a servant. Well, you don't want such a guy around your house.
We have an example where a guy was more or less tricked by a person. You know, the story about this guy has a business, and he takes this guy into his business.
Let's leave it. We have a big parsha to go through. No, Thursday night. We can't. This is one detail on the parsha. Let's move on. Okay. Okay.
And he also takes his wife.
Okay. We move on. The Torah tells us another thing that the Torah does not recommend but makes available, and that is the ability to sell one's daughter as a servant. What's the idea over here? The idea is when a person sees that all his finances are gone and he cannot feed his children, so then what's going to end up happening is the kids are going to start roaming the streets. They're going to be looking for food. And the Torah says, you send a young girl out on the streets looking for food, you're asking for trouble. So the Torah says, I'm going to make it available for you that you could help your kids go up the social ladder, even if you're at the very bottom, even if everything you've tried fails. How so? When a person sells his daughter as a servant, what happens is the following. You come to the wealthiest person in your city, and you say, I'm having a really tough time. You look for a good family where you would want your child to grow up. And you say, are you willing to bail me out? My daughter's very good. She cleans well. She's a help. She's pleasant. You're going to really enjoy having her around your house. You get your daughter all ready. And again, this is the last straw. This is when a person sees the alternative is that his daughter is going to roam the streets looking for food. So at that point, the Torah gives him an option. You go to the nicest family you could think of in town, a family you would want to marry into, but they're never going to look at you for 2 cents because they have better options than your family. And you tell them, why don't you take my daughter as a hired hand? She'll work by you for the next 6 years. And you'll only benefit from it. If they agree, what ends up happening is a bunch of things. Number one, your daughter gets well fed. She gets well clothed. Your daughter gets all the amenities of being in high class society. And two more things happen. When they pay the money is called kiddushin money. They give you the money, it's like a chuppah. They're giving you the money with the understanding, if we want to marry this girl, we've already paid the first step of marriage. We've already done kiddushin. You don't have to buy her a wedding ring. What's the idea behind it? The Torah is telling the one who purchased her, the Torah is telling him, either you or your son are hereby invited to marry this girl. The next 6 years, they're going to go around with this cute girl, helping them around the house. Every step of the way, she makes a good salad, she makes good food, the kids are growing up, and she's a part of the family. By the end of 6 years, it's very likely that one of the kids in the house says, I like Sprinza. I don't want her to leave. I want her to be a part of the family. And then the Torah gives us a mitzvah that the owner or one of his children have a mitzvah to marry her. So the Torah again creates a social structure where the kids who are most underprivileged, the kids who could end up being violated, taken advantage of, abused, those children have a way to get to the top of the social ladder. Again, the Torah doesn't like it. The Torah is telling you, if all else fails, you can do this. That's the idea of a Jewish girl being sold as a servant. Again, the idea, and that's why the Torah says that the master or his son, if they want to marry her, then the money they paid to purchase her is the kiddushin money. And then the Torah adds a mitzvah. The Torah says, if you marry her, even if you have a second wife, you cannot give her any less clothing, food, intimacy, time than your regular wife. She's a regular wife. In other words, the Torah is saying, you marry her, she's your equal. You cannot marry her and treat her any less just because your relationship started with her being a servant. She is not a servant now. She is now your wife. So the Torah here reveals to us what a man owes his wife. Meaning the Torah says, food, clothing, time, intimacy. The Torah is telling you there are bare minimums that every husband has to afford his wife. Yes, sir.
Seems like they're talking a lot about the privilege that the Ebony Greek gets, or even if it's not an Ebony Greek, you know, the privilege that the slave gets when anyway. So I'm wondering about this sort of a passage in Yirmiyahu where it's talking about how I think King Tzedekiah, he makes an oath that he will set all the slaves free, and then he goes back on his oath and everything. And that this is a big problem. So I'm wondering about the implications for this. Maybe this is a little off, but the implications that the slaves during this time, during Tzedekiah's time, were not treated as well as they should have been? Or,
okay. We'll get to that in a few minutes. The final point is, if the Jewish servant doesn't want to go free, we discussed the servant can ask to have an extension, and then there's this whole procession of having their ear pierced. Ears pierced is a sign of slavery from the days of Adam. From the days of Adam Arishon, wearing an earring or having an ear pierced was a sign of slavery. So this was a... that's the idea that the Torah is saying. You want to enter long-term slavery, we'll allow you to do it. Notice what's happening here. The guy is accepting to be a servant long-term, and he gets no money. It couldn't have been such a bad deal to be a servant in a Jewish home if there are people that want an extension on the relationship without getting a penny in return. Here we see that the relationship was really a good relationship. It was positive. Yes. We'll get back to you.
Only how modern society then means that it's okay that men and women cross dress, including the fact that men and women both have is constituted a good thing if men has piercings.
Okay. Torah tells us that a murderer could get the death penalty. What happens if a person kills by mistake? He lost control of the car. Torah says he has to go to a city of refuge. The cities of refuge were given extra holiness, and they protect a person. Here we see that relatives, this idea of honor killings, has a basis in the Torah. The idea that if someone by mistake killed one's relative, then he goes after the killer. And he tells them, you know, you make mistakes in your taxes, you make mistakes in your laundry, you don't make mistakes in killing people. And so the person has to go to a city of refuge because the relatives are legitimate in wanting him dead for killing their relative. Again, if it were something that was completely beyond his control, it's a different deal. Here we're talking about something where it was a mistake. He did adequate... he took adequate care, but he could have taken better care. Okay, so he pays a price. Torah says a person shouldn't think that if they murdered, but then they start doing holy things, they'll get away with it. Even if a person runs to the altar, we pull him away from the altar. We don't say, he's a Kohen, we need him, he's a holy person, he's there by the altar. No, people have to realize that murder is serious, and the Torah is not going to let people get away with it. Torah tells us, don't think it's just murder that's serious. There are other things that are serious as well. If a person wounds their parent purposely, they'll also get the death penalty for it. So there's a special prohibition against wounding a parent, causing a parent to bleed. And that's why ideally we prefer not being our own parents' doctors. Ideally, you get them a different doctor. If you're a dentist, let them have a different dentist. Make a deal with your fellow dentist. You'll treat his parents, he'll treat your parents. Let someone else be the one to give them the shot, to pull their teeth, to do these painful things. A person shouldn't do it for their parents. If their parent needs them, sometimes a parent needs a shot 3 times a day. A parent's a diabetic, they need their blood checked. Sometimes a parent, you can't call in a nurse 5 times a day to check their blood sugar level. So under those circumstances, the child does what they have to do. But if it were possible, you ask the spouse to do it. Meaning if there's a son and a son-in-law, a son and a daughter-in-law, so ideally someone else should do it. We should try to avoid doing something, even in their interest, and wounding the parents. Again, if there's no alternative, if the parent would be very uncomfortable by it, if it would hurt the relationship, etc., so then we are lenient where necessary. The Torah says that someone who kidnaps and sells the kidnapped also gets a death penalty. If you make him work, you ask him, could you just bring in the groceries? Then one would get the death penalty. So that's the warning against kidnapping. Torah says, one who curses his parents with Hashem's name also gets a death penalty. So the Torah is teaching us, it's not only over murder you get the death penalty. There's also a certain relationship, respect you're supposed to have for our parents, respect for human rights, realizing that stealing a human being is more severe than stealing someone's pen. Stealing a pen is also severe, but stealing a human being is more severe. Yes?
What does the Torah mean by, say, Kalel Aviv Beinu? Like today, like someone says, like a curse word to their parent, or just like...
It's all wrong.
What?
It's all wrong. It says you're not allowed to even make a move that puts down the parent. Your dad says, the Mets won the 96 World Series. And you go, right. So that's, even though it's not important whether the Mets won or didn't win, but you put them down. It says, Arur makle aviv imo. Cursed is one who derides his parent. It's enough just to make a move. It can be a look of the eye that says you're putting them down. That's all prohibited. Cursing over here specifically is cursing with Hashem's name. That's a death penalty. But the idea of respecting parents is also our perspective. We're supposed to look up to them. Yes?
We do class on
Yeah, great idea. Remind me this Thursday. Remind me. The Simcha. Yes, sir.
Does this apply to the parents of a ger or someone that has a non-Jewish father?
So, it goes like this. When a person converts to Judaism, technically the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Aim, the biblical mitzvah, is not relevant. But the rabbis imposed on him the mitzvah. The rabbi said a person shouldn't convert to Judaism and start treating his parents not nicely. That would certainly put Judaism in a bad light. People would say, look at that, before he converted, he was nice, he was respectful, he was a decent human being. He converted, and now he treats his parents like 2 cents. So the rabbis imposed the rabbinic obligation to treat one's parents respectfully, even though technically, halachically, we say when a person converted, it's like they're not related to their parents. Okay, there's also an element of decency. You know, these people brought a person to the world. There's also an element of hakarat tov. You owe something to them. Okay, Torah says if a person damaged someone else, he has to pay nezek, the damage. You cut off a finger, now the person can do less typing, so you have to evaluate how much that's worth. Tsar, you evaluate the pain. If a person were to undergo what you just did to them, but they could do it with a painkiller, how much would they pay for that painkiller? Tsar. Ripu, you pay their medical bills. You tell a guy, I can get you a doctor for free. He could say, yeah, and I'll get what I pay for. No. Halacha says he's allowed to insist on a medical care that you pay for, and that's something you guys should know. People sometimes skimp in areas they should not skimp. You want to be cheap? There are areas you shouldn't be cheap about. One of them is medicine. Sometimes I have a friend who... I mean, I think he makes over $250,000 shekel a year, by my estimation. I mean, he has a nice living. And he needed, his wife needed certain medical care. So he kept going to the kupa. So one day I called him over and I said, you know, your wife has this problem. Why aren't you going to the experts to get her the care she needs? And he tells me, the experts are very expensive. I said, really, the experts are very expensive. So he says, come on, you're talking about 1,000, 2,000 shekel a visit. I said to him, okay, I'll cover the 2,000 shekel a visit. Take your wife to the expert. And the guy looked at me like I was crazy. He knows he's making 10 times as much as I am. So the guy says, what do you mean? I said, your wife needs medical care. You're not getting her good medical care because you're saying it's expensive. If you don't want to cover, don't tell her. I'll give you the money. Take her to the medical care. So he never came for the money, which was nice. but he did take his wife to the better medical care, and she got cured. So the guy spent years with his wife suffering after about 3-4 years that I was aware of it. I said, yeah, this is ridiculous. He could spend the money on a car. He could spend the money on going on fancy vacations. He should certainly spend the money to get his wife the care she needs. So he didn't do it because he doesn't love his wife. He does. But in his perspective, he always thought, if I get free care at the Kupa and I get a decent care from my regular medical plan, why should I pay more? The halacha tells us, if a person was harmed, then we owe it to pay their medical care. And a person can insist, I don't want cheap medical care. You give me a free doctor, I'm getting what I pay for. The halacha is teaching us a perspective. In medicine, you get what you pay for. That doesn't always mean the expensive doctor is better. But it does mean that very often the cheap doctor is worse. You have to find out. And that's an area that very often it pays to pay more for. People go to a cheap dentist. Okay, and he doesn't find any cavities. And then they discover they have a root canal and they need a crown, and they're out 15,000 shekel. Now you tell me, would they have been better off with a dentist who would have found the cavity and charged them 500 shekel to fill the cavity, 1,000 shekel to fill the cavity? They would have had the tooth, they wouldn't have had the root canal, they wouldn't have had the crown, and they would have come ahead on financially. So the Torah is teaching us, It pays to get a good doctor. It costs you a little bit more in the long run. Usually, it's well worth the investment. Rapo yirape is the monetary responsibility to pay the medical bills of the person who was harmed. And the Talmud derives from that, you have to pay. You can't give him free medical care if he doesn't want it. From here, we also derive that doctors are allowed to work. You might think, hey, we're spiritual people. If God wants you to be healthy, He'll make you healthy. Why are you going to the doctor? So from here we derive that, no, Hashem gave us the medical capacity to cure things or to find cures for things, and we're supposed to take advantage of that. Yes?
On the other side, Hizkiyahu did hide the book of medicine. He said people were not fearing God enough.
Right. It's a good question. Right? We move on. It's a good question.
Is there something after that?
Yes, for a different class. Remind me, no. If you want, this deserves a class. Meaning there's a lot to discuss about it. Ramban wrote about it, but it involves preparing sources. If they remind me, we'll have a class on it. It's not just a Q&A, 2-minute question and answer. No. Okay, Torah tells us if a Jew gets upset at his non-Jewish servant and he hits him with a stick and then the guy dies, so he gets a death penalty. Torah says that's murder. You can't do that. The Torah says what happens if a person intends to hit his friend and by mistake he misses, and he hits a pregnant lady, and she miscarries. So then the Torah describes the monetary penalty that the husband has to pay. The Torah uses the words like this. If there will be an ason, if there will be ason in modern Hebrew means a tragedy. In the Torah, it means a death. If there will be a death, so then he can get killed for killing. He didn't mean to kill her, but he didn't mean to kill his friend. He obviously was winding up to punch him so hard to kill him, so he meant to kill Reuven, and instead he killed Shimon. So he'll get the death penalty for that. I didn't mean to kill him. You know, I was shooting to kill Reuven. I missed. I killed Shimon. Okay. But yeah, there was still intent to kill. So the Torah says he could get the death penalty. But here we see that a fetus, before it sticks out its head, that's not considered killing. Meaning if he caused her to miscarry, so even though it's prohibited to have an abortion, even from day one, you can't just say, there's no baby here yet. From our end, abortions are prohibited. There can be scenarios where it would be permissible because an abortion is not as severe as murder. That's where the Torah says, if the woman dies, that's called murder. If the baby dies, that's not called murder. It's severe. He'll get taxed for it. It's prohibited to do an abortion. But it's not murder. And as such, there can be scenarios, depending on what trimester, depending on if it's before the first 40 days, after the first 40 days, depending on the need base, but there can be scenarios where the halacha is willing to discuss an abortion. There can be such things. We move on. We have the famous pasuk, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot. And our tradition says you don't do that. We do not take out an eye, even if he took out someone else's eye. Our tradition over here, here we see the power of tradition. The verse seems to literally say it. Take out an eye for an eye. And our tradition is no. He'll have to pay for an eye. If he blinded his friend's eye, so we evaluate how much that's worth, and he pays for that. Yes, sir.
When I read the text afterwards, they say this for 95 and so on, they explain afterwards that it's the value, it's not the...
That's what I just said, yeah. The monetary value. You don't...
But it is like explained like a black and white afterwards, not like something...
Show me. Show me.
This process is used a lot. My question stems from the extreme where, details aside, where he would have to pay the value of the person as a whole. And let's say it comes out to, I don't know, $20,000. But I'm saying you're going to put this Jewish soul is worth $20,000.
No, the soul is not.
He lost his eye, right?
Right.
And the eye is not worth, say, $5,000. An eye is, you can't put a price on an eye.
Yes, you can. Again, we break it down to Nezek, Tzar, Sheves, Ripui, Boishes. You have to pay five components. The damage, the pain, the medical bills, the shame, and the unemployment.
If you ask someone how much would they be willing to keep their eye, they wouldn't tell you...
Okay, so the Torah is telling you, but that's nonetheless your responsibility of payment. Again, remember, you're evaluating the pain separate from the damage. The damage separate from the unemployment. Unemployment separate from the shame. Shame separate from the medical bills. You have five components that you have to pay for. Now, there's a biblical prohibition to damage someone else.
Right.
A person can't say, okay, I'm going to sock you, but afterwards... Oh, no. I said to the wrong person. Oh, boy, what a scary look. a person's not allowed to say, I'm going to hit you and then I'll pay you. There's a biblical prohibition against damaging someone else. I didn't mean you. Coming back to our parsha, I guess it was scary to hear me say that too, huh? Torah says if one's ox damages, so here we see our responsibility for our animals. Ox doesn't only mean an ox, it means every animal. So we have different forms of damages. There's damage that's unusual. Your animal doesn't ordinarily do this. So nonetheless, if the animal killed, the animal gets killed. Here there's a broad discussion, do we view animals as having free will? Why does the animal get killed? Rambam says there's an element where the animal is held accountable. Rambam says you don't hold the animal accountable, it's all to punish the master, the owner of the animal. Ramban questions that. He says, But the halacha says that even if an animal that has no owner kills someone, it also gets killed. Who are you punishing there? There is no owner. So that leads to a broad discussion of understanding Ramban. Well, does Ramban understand that animals have free will? Does an animal understand it's killing when it kills? Why do we kill the ox that was that had no owner when it gored someone to death? What's the logic behind it? So that's a broad discussion. we have the concept that after an animal gores three times, we consider that an animal that's already proven what's called mu'ad. It's proven itself to be a harmful animal. Right. So that leads us to another halachic discussion of what makes a chazakah. How many times does something have to happen in order for us to say, I see a pattern? So two opinions here, whether after two times or after three times. And in halacha, we don't really rule on this. It depends on the scenario. So, for example, if a person had a boy, and they circumcised the boy, and he died. So we say, okay, that can happen. 1 in 100 kids after their circumcision needs extra help to stop the bleeding. Meaning the average circumcision is fine. 1 in 100, you need to either cauterize or sew or use chemicals. 1 in 100 really needs extra care to stop the bleeding. So it happened, and this kid, something happened. They couldn't stop the bleeding. The kid died. Okay, next child's born. They circumcise him. He dies. So now we say, wait a second, two kids? We're not risking it again. Ah, but 1 in 100, right, but this was 2. But chazaka takes 3, so we say no. In areas of danger, once it happened twice, we're concerned there's a pattern, we don't do it again. Same thing, if you're offered to date someone, and they tell you, okay, but she has an uncle who has serious mental health issues, or she has an uncle who had a serious illness or whatever. So we say, okay, there are different people who have different illnesses. There are different people that have issues. Every family, statistically, every family has one person that has mental health issues. That's the statistic. If you look, if you know enough, the uncles, the aunts, the cousins, the siblings, the nephews, the nieces, statistically, any normal family will have one such person. But what happens if it's 2? If it's 2 of her sisters, if it's 2 of her aunts. So again, even though chazakah, we say, has to happen 3 times ordinarily to have a chazakah, in areas that there's room to be concerned medically, we say after 2 times we're concerned. We say, do a better verification before you marry into the family. Find out. You should understand better what's going on there. Coming back to our parasha, that stems from the machlokas of understanding how many times does the ox have to gore in order for it to become an ox that's viewed as a goring ox. One opinion says twice, one opinion says 3 times. We say, in monetary matters, we'll say 3. On health matters, we'll say 2. Back to our parasha. Torah tells us we have a responsibility not only over our assets, but also over things that we don't own, but we affect. So you're walking down the street, and you drop your glasses, and they go into the sewer. So you got muscles, you take off the cover of the sewer, very heavy thing, you put it on the side, you climb down, you take out your glasses. Now you're late, you're rushing to work, so you leave. And you forget to cover the sewer. Wait, but I don't own that sewer. It's not mine. It's public domain. Public property. Says the halacha, you're responsible for the damages. The bar, you create a pit and people fall into it. You uncovered a pit, you created a pit, you dug a pit, people fall into it, even though it's not, I don't own it, it's not my property, it's not my possession, I have responsibility. So you're rushing to mincha, but you want a drink. So you fill your cup, and you gulp it down, and you spill on the floor. But you got to run to mincha, right? So you leave the spill, and you run to daven. When you come back, there's someone on the floor, he broke his leg, he slipped on your spill. That's also a version of bar. You're responsible to pay. The halacha says a pit doesn't only have to be a pit that's dug. If you created some form of stumbling block in public domain, you left a spill, you left something that people could get hurt on, so then you're responsible. And this is not only if I created it, even if I walked by. I once brought my kids to school, and on my way back, I see a building, a construction site. Here in Givat Shul, today you see a big building there. Once upon a time, they were digging to lay the foundations there, and they had dug, I would say, between 20 and 30 meters deep. It was really deep. Now, at the edge of the street, you had a fence that blocked access to this huge, I mean, it was a huge drop to the foundations of this building. Great. The only thing was, the fence had moved. And the edge of the fence was a pit where a person could fall 30 meters. So, children, you have about 150 to 200 children walking to and from school down that block, and there's a pit 20 to 30 meters deep. So I stopped, and I called the city. I called 106, and I said, you know, there's a pit here that kids can fall and get hurt. And this is a street that leads to three or four schools. There are hundreds of kids that walk down this block. And it took the city about 2 hours to get there. And I spent the next 2 hours standing by that pit. Because you can't just walk by when you see something that's a danger that could harm other people. You have to deal with it. You can't say, it's not my problem. It is your problem. But my kids are already safely in school. Right. But there are other people's children who are walking by there. Back to our parsha. The Torah describes if an ox unexpectedly gores another ox. So there's a special halacha that you only pay half the damages. And there's another halacha that you don't pay more than the value of the goring ox. So you can have an ox that's worth 100 shekel, goring an ox that's worth 1,000 shekel. Technically, you should pay half the damages, 500 shekel, but you don't pay more than the value of the goring ox, so you'll get away with paying only 100 shekel. Okay, so that's a special halacha, because they lived with oxen walking in their public streets. You were doing something legitimate. You didn't have to expect your ox one day would suddenly wake up on the wrong side of the bed and decide to gore the neighboring ox. What you did was legitimate. You didn't do something irresponsible. The way they led life was their oxen were walking back and forth among them. Torah tells us if you steal. So ordinarily a person that's caught stealing has to pay double. Okay, a person that stole has to pay double. What if you stole a person's livelihood, his sheep or his ox? So there the Torah says you have to pay more. Over an ox, you have to pay five times the value of an ox. Over a sheep, you have to pay four times the value. That's if you slaughtered it, if you ate it, or you resold it. If you did one of those two things, if they catch it in your possession, you can give it back. But if not, you do. You have to pay that. Torah gives us another very, very important concept in the next mitzvah. Let's say you're lying in bed at night and you hear digging. So you get up, you take out your machete, and you stand there watching. And suddenly a head peeps in. And you see there's a thief trying to, he's dug into your house. So you use the machete. And the next thing you know, there's a head rolling on your dining room table. There's a head rolling there. So you look down at the head and you say, oh, I'm so sorry. he goes, that's okay, right? So the halacha says, you're absolved. That was okay. You're legitimate. Why is it legitimate? Because our assumption is that when people come to steal from you, they know that you might catch them and put up a fight. And that means they came in prepared to kill you. They did not come in just to take your money. When someone breaks into your house, they're not just coming in for money. So the Torah says, you see a thief breaking into your house, you're allowed to kill him. Because you have to realize that what's happening now is your life is in danger. The person did not just come in for money. He knew you might wake up. He knew you might put up a fight. And he's ready to kill you. So the Torah says you're allowed to kill him. Exception. What happens if a person recognizes that it's his father? It's his father that's breaking into his house. So then the Torah says, put away that machete. You can pick up your brass knuckles, but you can't use a machete. meaning, you can put up a fight, but you're not allowed to kill him. because he would never kill you if it's a normal father, meaning under normal a normal right. What happens if it's the son? Then you pick up your machete. Because a son is capable of killing his father. A father, under normal circumstances, would not kill his son. A son, if he's ready to rob his father, you can't know what he would do. But if it's the father, so then the son knows that a father would never kill him for his money. Again, under normal circumstances. This teaches us a concept. If someone's entering my domain, and I have reason to think that they're ready to kill me, so the Torah says, kill him first. Don't wait to see if he's coming to kill you. That's the idea of someone's coming to kill you. You get up an hour earlier and kill him first. Now, obviously, this isn't telling us to be a loose trigger. You know, we have to be smart. But there is this concept. I don't wait. When you think someone's ready to kill you, you shoot first. They have a rule that they say, but I can't say it on the record. So I'll tell you what they say without going into the details. They say, better have his mother crying than your mother crying. And the rest we'll say when we're off the record. Back to our parsha. Guys, there's a value to being at Machon Meir. Can't put everything online. Yes?
In Holland, it's forbidden to beat and thief death, especially when you are having a machete. Then they see it first to be murder.
Okay. Yeah, in the United States, it's not so simple either, and in Israel, it's not so simple either. Okay, but the Torah is teaching us a healthy perspective. The Torah is teaching us how we're supposed to approach life. Okay, we've only gotten up to Shlishi. Torah tells us if our animal goes to someone else's yard and eats their crops, we have to pay. So we're responsible to watch our animals. You can't tell the neighbor, watch your daisies, put a better fence up around your daisies. No, put a better chain on your dog. Your dog shouldn't be eating my daisies. You have to watch your animals. They don't consume other people's property. You made a barbecue. You made a bonfire. It was an honor of Rabbi Shimon Balanes. The only problem is it got out of control and it burned down someone else's field. Torah says you have to pay. You'll say, but it was the wind. So here we learn, if there's an outside force, but I should have anticipated that force, then I'm responsible. I can't just say it was the wind. Now this applies not only to a fire. This applies to I sometimes put out food to cool off on the porch. We have very strong winds in Kochav Yaakov. Sometimes the stuff goes flying. You know, if something went flying and damaged someone, so that's called like a fire that went out of control. You have to pay for that. You can't say, well, I didn't expect the wind. Well, you should have expected it. There are normal winds where you live. And just like if the wind pushes a flame to damage someone else, you have to pay for it. If it knocks things off your porch and it hits someone down below and damages them, so again, you're responsible. Why'd you leave it in a place where your downstairs neighbor could get hurt by it? Yes?
Like, when I read and understand it, you say, when I have an eye, all those things, like, you have to first assemble with a slave, you know, if you heard
Let's
this
talk
eye,
about it one-on-one. We got too much to cover here.
It's free. It's not free.
Torah gives us the mitzvah of the mitzvah of watching one another's objects. So you're running out, you're leaving for Bein Hazmanim. You ask your roommate, can you keep an eye on my stuff? So your roommate is a shomer chinam. That means I'm taking responsibility, but you're not paying me anything, right? How much responsibility do I have? I have responsibility not to be negligent. You're going away for Shabbos. You don't want to leave your wallet, your passport, and everything in the machon. You come to Rav Listman and you say, Rabbi, can I leave you my documents? I don't want to leave them here. We all know that the machon doesn't lock the front door. and people can walk in any time of day and any time of night. So it's a smart thing. You don't leave your laptop here, you don't leave your cell phone here, you don't leave your wallet and your important papers here. You know, we can't protect you from theft. There's a reality here. Every year, some people get their wallets and cell phones and money and documents stolen. It's your responsibility. So you walk over to Rav Listman and you say, Rabbi, I want you to watch my stuff for me. How much responsibility does he have? He's called the Shomer Chinam. His responsibility is to give it basic, adequate protection, not to be poshea, not to be negligent. So if Rav Listman leaves his office and leaves the office door unlocked, that's called negligence. That's not adequate protection. If you lock the office door, I don't know what to do to put it in a safe. Normal protection is you leave it in a room that's locked that only certain people have the key to. That's normal protection. But if I leave it in a room that's unlocked, I didn't give it adequate protection. So we have, this is where we'll pick up Thursday night, the delineation of the different responsibilities. What happens if I borrow your lawnmower? I want to borrow your bike. How much responsibility do I have? So that's delineated in our parsha. How much responsibility do you have when you borrow? What happens if I pay you? I want you to watch my stuff. I'll pay you 5 shekel for watching my stuff over Shabbos. Oh, then I gain. Because then you're a shomer sachar. You're a guard that's been paid. You owe me more protection. I only paid you 5 shekel. But it shifted your status from being a shomer chinam, a free watcher, to being a paid guard. Now you owe me more. So that's where we'll pick up is on Shem Thursday night.